Jonas Mekas was born in 1922 in a farming village in Lithuania. 1944, he was taken by the Nazis to a forced labor camp, he and his brother, Adolphus. After the war, they ended up immigrating here to the United States in about 1949, part of a UN refugee organization. They settled in Williamsburg. 2 months after his arrival in New York, he borrowed money to buy his first Bolex camera. And he began to shoot film. He hasn't stopped. Jonas Mekas, one of the founders of the Anthology Film Archives. This year, in December, he will turn 95 years old. Jonas Mekas is the guest on this episode. Also on this episode of FilmWax Radio, actress-turned-journalist Jennifer Merrin. Jennifer is a fixture in the film scene here in New York, showing up at screenings. Ms. Merrin, avid feminist, became the actual subject of the news last year or the year before when the deed to her family home in Queens was forged and squatters moved into her home and destroyed it for all intents and purposes. Jennifer Merrin will be on in the second segment to tell her story, which you won't want to miss. So this is probably one of those episodes that will go down as one of the best. Jonas Mekas is on the program. I should also mention that Jonas was a father late in life. His two terrific grown children, Sebastian and Una. Una's a friend. We co-starred. I guess you can't say that we co-starred. I mean, we were among the cast of a film that was made a number of years ago, and I met her there, and she swept me off my feet. Let me just put it that way. Well, now I'm finally glad that I have her dad on FilmWax Radio, so let's get to it. Okay, here is something I've been hoping to do and finally got to do, which is sit down with Jonas Mekas. We're joined by Phong Bui, who is an artist, writer, and a curator in his own right. He's the artistic director of the Brooklyn Rail, and he will be joining us in this conversation with one of the great experimental filmmakers, Jonas Mekas. Well, let me thank you both, first of all. This is very exciting for me, talking with Jonas Mekas finally.
Happy to be with you, yes.
Thank you. And Phong Bui, who is the, I'm going to get this right, co-founder and artistic director of the Brooklyn Rail, which everybody in Brooklyn knows because you see the publication in many, many locations and many people are reading it. And then it's also has a significant web presence. So you're welcome. Covering arts and politics and more, right? I'm sorry.
Film, poetry, and whatnot. Many other topics.
Okay, very good. One topic of which we're going to get around today, which is the capital campaign, which Anthology Film Archives is in the midst of. Correct, Jonas?
For building an additional floor on top of the existing building our library. Paper materials, documentation, audio collection. We have a vast, really, collection of materials. It's all, most of it in boxes now, not available to scholars, researchers, and we would like to make it all available.
It's incredible, must be an incredible rich history of experimental underground cinema.
It covers also the history of various film societies that existed and organizations on the East Coast and some West Coast also, going back to 1940, somewhere there. So it's a lot of material. We have a minimal library, like one room, available right now. But most of it is not available.
Where are all these boxes? I'm just curious.
Some
currently
are stored outside, and the basement is full of boxes. And it's
so you can also centralize everything.
You see, the building, this building in which we are, is a former courthouse building.
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah.
We have practically three floors. One floor is, I mean, we had two movie theaters and then a film vault in which we have about 30,000 films. I mean, people come here to see the films and they don't realize what else is there in this building.
Yeah.
They do not realize that we have about 30,000 films here. It's mostly original materials and the video and audio collection and actually our paper materials library contains like also original scripts. Like we have Orson Welles' original script with Orson Welles' notes for
which film?
Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane? You have the original?
It's in our library.
That's
in Or we have
amazing.
Joseph Cornell working materials, books, uh-huh. magazines from which he cut out his angels and for his art. A lot of documentation. Harry Smith, a huge collection of Harry Smith's anthropological collections and films and, of course,
Harry
paintings.
Smith. So Harry we know him Smith. From his music, the blue, from getting American yes. roots music, but he also had much more.
Yes, much, much more.
Jump in any time, Fong, I beg your pardon. How did you become associated with this?
I mean, I had a wonderful professor in college who had taken classes with Stan Brakhage when he was teaching at Art Institute of Chicago. Must have been in mid-70s or so. So when I came to Philadelphia in 1980, I went to school and took an incredible film class, and I grew up with an uncle who had a theater in Hue. The Imperial Theatre of Hue. So I grew up with film all my life, but I wasn't that realizing that there was Jonas. So through this professor, I was exposed to experimental films, and immediately when I came to New York, probably we met through Raymond Abraham, the great Austrian
architect. Designed to transform this courthouse building, which was a ruin when I got it into a film museum.
Yeah.
You see, this is designed by Raymond Abraham.
Oh. He's knocking against
stairway into the projection room.
A spiral stairwell in the middle of the second floor landing, I guess, or lobby. And what is this? Is this steel? Steel. Yeah. It's not bamboo, that much I can... And I'm really excited.
And we actually met through, I think, Raymond Abraham, the architect.
So he's alive and well?
No, he passed away?
I'm sorry.
He was in a car crash, unfortunately, yes.
So, it was basically immediate attraction, and I was very happy to have met Jonas. And then 2003, I think that's when we spent most of our time, at least, twice a week. So he moved to Greenpoint, where I live. So that's when we became better friends. And throughout the years, the friendship got deepened because partly what Jonas has done represent the kind of culture that I've always felt compelled to follow that sort of path. So it's just an easy match in terms of friendship and what he's done. So I felt like I need to do what Jonas has done to carry through that incredible history, that continuity. So here we are. 2 months ago, Jonas asked me to join the board. I was gladly to say yes and help to get involved with the campaign to build this incredible Heaven on Earth library and cafe, as Jonas described.
No one mentioned the cafe, Jonas.
Yes, next to the building, we have empty lot space. So there, we are going to build a cafe. Mm-hmm. Cafe accessible to all our patrons and also accessible to the neighborhood. So that will help us financially because Ontology operates on a quite a sizable deficit. So that should help us.
Yeah.
With an extension actual on the roof. their library and then their cafe. We, if needed, we can extend it to the roof, rent it out for parties. Mm-hmm. Now that will be helpful.
Yeah. And of course,
many
you can rent
art
out
organizations
the theaters.
That do not have their own like premises and they work in rented spaces. Do not. So we are lucky. We are lucky that we have this building.
Oh yeah.
We can, if we can build it up, or we, we are.
Yeah.
It was a very good decision. I bought the building in 1979 from the city in an auction
for like a buck or two.
Yeah, for $50,000.
Yeah. But and today course, that's probably $500,000. But
they are offering us $30 million. But I say thank you, goodbye, because I put $2 million. It took me 10 years and $2 million to transform it to what we have now.
Yeah.
And when it was a, it's also, there are some funny details from the history, like, Harvey Keitel, when it was still a courthouse, mm-hmm. Harvey Keitel worked in it as, he had his first job in this building as a court stenographer.
He was a stenographer? But he was like...
He has horrible memories of it. when he walked in once when we during the premiere of Ulysses Gaze, in which he stars, and he panicked. Like, this is the building I was at my... I was working. Yeah, horrible memories. And of course,
Javits.
Javits was one of the judges.
Oh yeah, is that right?
Yes. Warhol shut when it later when the courthouse was already closed and was used by some artists for 1 year. St. Mark's Church had it for 1 year as a like an arts center. Andy Warhol shot filmed two of his movies here.
Oh wow.
Henry Geldzahler and Emil D'Antonio drinking beer. Mm-hmm. And when in 1954, I brought out the first issue of Film Culture magazine. Yeah. The publisher, Franciscan Monastery on Willoughby Avenue in Brooklyn, Clinton Hill, sued me. I had to appear in this building.
Oh, really? Tell me, why were you sued?
Because he
couldn't pay the bill to the printer. I arranged the printing of the first issue of Film Culture.
Oh, I see.
On time, like promising that, oh yes, everybody will buy this magazine, and as soon as it comes out, I will pay you the bill. No, the magazine came out, and I gave it out to friends. Very few people bought it.
You may still find copies in the new library. You'll find copies.
Yes, in the library.
Can you imagine the magazine was filled with lengthy writing in a very intelligible, analytical way by Annette Michelson, by Andrew Sarris, Pierre M. Sidney. It's not going to be a great commercial success. But that's what Jonas didn't realize until he was sued by these Franciscan monks.
Well,
in any case, they sued me, and I had to appear
in the court that was here.
Which was this building.
Yeah, amazing. And little
story? Well, let him tell another story, which is even more extraordinary. He's one of his early friends.
There are so many anecdotes.
No, but you must share the story of Jerome Hill, Jonas, how the building got funded.
I bought the building, really. Jerome Hill was the one. Jerome Hill comes from St. Paul. He came from St. He was the neighbor of Scott. Fitzgerald Scott.
Oh, yeah, Scott Fitzgerald. Okay.
Yes, on Summit Street, I think, yes.
In St. Paul,
and
Minnesota.
And she was one of our early sponsors when we opened on 425 Lafayette Street.
Your first location.
The public theater in 1970. He paid for building a theater, very special theater, where you could see the films, and nobody, you could not see who is sitting on your left or right or who is in front. It was a very specially designed theater. It was only the film and you, like very, very, right. very. But and then he also paid for the collection of films. And then he dies, and he leaves a little piece of land in the Florida Keys, which we sent somebody to look at it. And this guy comes back, says, "You should sell it immediately because the ocean is eating your land." Mm-hmm. It was disappearing. So we sold it, and we got $50,000, and I put it in the bank. Said, "I will use it only when we really, for some, you know, really...
Right, urgent.
When we really need it."
Yeah.
And it came up that that this building was still available, though it's like a shell. In 1979, was totally...
The whole area was the shell, right?
And the area was drug-infested, very bad area, but the building was there. And the building department tried to talk me out from buying it. It cost you a lot of money to fix it up. I said, I want it.
You had a vision.
But then when I decided that I wanted for anthology film archives... Then everybody else decided that they also wanted. So I managed to, thanks to Henry Geltzahler, who was the commissioner for cultural affairs under Koch, when Koch was
in
the
Koch
mayor,
administration.
Ed Koch. Mm-hmm. He restricted it to... organizations that were not for profit could
bid for the space.
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So that then then it was on the La Mama and Anthology Film Archives,
which is a couple few blocks
comes
away.
And La Mama backed out.
Oh, they wanted
but
the space.
But there were some others there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it came up, 50,000. I lift my hand, and clunk. We have the building, with the 50,000 that we got for that little island
in the Keys,
land in the Keys. Florida Keys that the ocean was eating up.
The 25th had become 50 with interest and over time. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's 50, yes.
Oh, very good. That is a great story.
That's the building.
So, wow, it really feels like it was meant to be in the way you describe it. And who would have known, maybe you knew, Jonas, 40 years later, that, there would be all these condos being built around the East Village and that...
that we needed space.
Yeah, no, I know that.
And it was a good decision because many art organizations of that period that operated from rented spaces have closed, have just disappeared.
A lot of
they had to move to other areas.
Even you had to move out of the East Village and move to Brooklyn.
From public theater from 425 Lafayette. We moved to 80 Worcester, mm-hmm. To 80 Worcester, which was the first cooperative building that George Mechunas had established. That was like the beginning of Soho, mm-hmm. And then we took the ground floor and the basement, and that's until 1980. We operated from there,
and then to this space,
and then we had to close for a short period, and we opened here at this at the current building in the fall of 89.
Oh, how long? So how long was 89. The place? How long were you closed then? Is that sound almost like you're
it's
saying
It's a
nine
very
years?
Complicated okay. history in between.
Yeah. Okay. All that matters, though, is that this campaign is going on now. You know, I don't want to get lofty about it, but it's almost like a, you know, it's a, it seems like it's just getting off the ground in a whole new level.
Yes, because we have also to redo the whole building and the base, because we did not have money to really finish the way we wanted.
Oh, originally.
In the original plans, the library part was there, oh. and the cafe was there, and also, of course, we have huge basement that goes under the sidewalk, which has to be also,
yes.
We have to use it also.
Of course. And I believe you can get to the Second Avenue subway through your basement. There's this secret entrance that you have, like the Rockefellers.
I don't know what will happen when that subway.
Hey,
I hope it won't be like when the mm-hmm. Museum of Modern Art's film theater was between 1915 and 1970, somewhere there. It was just next to the subway.
Oh, and,
you could hear it.
Sure,
you
like at the Angelica Theater, which is...
You watch a silent movie and you hear, you know, the subway.
Exactly.
As a soundtrack for it.
Have you ever been to the Angelica Film Center?
They have different spaces there, so it depends on which theater you are.
It's all by it. It's all under the F line. Fongs, how much is the goal? How much is the capital campaign for? If there is indeed a set.
Yes.
What is the timeline?
Originally, like 3 years ago, when we began making plans, it was $6 million. But during last 2 years, all prices jumped up. So now it's like closer to $8 million.
Okay.
So, but that's maybe about it. So the plan is now there is this wonderful person in Arles. She lives between Arles and London, and she's building an art center right now in Arles, designed by Gary. She is also a great supporter of arts and artists and exhibitions. And she came up with she said, if you raise like up to $3 million yourself, I will match it.
You'll
dollar
match it.
For dollar.
That's what so you call that means an angel investor.
If I raise $3 million, then she will match up to $3 million, and it will we will have six. So now we had a week or so ago, we had an art auction, and we managed to raise $2 million. So that means we have $4 million because she's matching. So that means we have half almost of the money.
Well, if you're raising $8 million, or you have to raise only have to raise $3 million now because
but we have half of the. Total budget, the $4 million is half of our $8 million. So we still have to raise another $4 million. But we are now moving full speed. We know that we can, we have 1 year to raise the remaining $4 million. Artists have been, it's amazing. I mean, I go back to when we bought originally this building, and I began fixing it up. And I approached Hollywood companies, producers, and everybody said, no, they came and they took a look, and they said, hopeless, hopeless, don't even start, don't do anything, this is hopeless. Mm-hmm. They looked at the building, and really, it was hopeless. I went ahead, nobody,
believed in you.
So... And who comes to my help? Agnes Martin. When she found it, when I told her about this, She came and gave the original monies to start to produced an art portfolio, and she sponsored the production of the art portfolio. So from the very beginning, it was the artists. And now the auction, which, you know, gave us $2 million, the auction.
Yeah.
So again, the artists. And and all my attempts to talk, to find, to make some contacts in film industry. Mm-hmm. Here we are. We are building a library for cinema. And we are, like, every Wednesday, we have a program of the new filmmakers. Mm-hmm. For the last 15 years, we have presented, like, hundreds of feature films, for first features. Mm-hmm. And many of them went into the industry. We are like beginning. Okay, you know, our main mission is to show and preserve the non-commercial alternative forms of cinema. Alternative forms of cinema.
That's the key. That's what Jonah just said there. Alternative is the key, because in Jonah's anti-100 years cinema manifesto, I used to remember all of it almost at one point. But I think what I remember was significant was at the times when everybody wants to succeed in sale. This is Jonah's. I want to celebrate those who embrace social and daily failure to pursue the invisible, the personal things that bring no money, no bread, and no contemporary history or any kind of art history. We are for each other as friends what we do. Something of that nature. And I think that goes back.
Yes, because the cinema is a big tree with, you know, many branches. And we see what's presented, supported, mm-hmm. and written about is that, like, those public mm-hmm. big branches, the mm-hmm. commercial public branches of cinema. And the more personal, smaller branches, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. More personal, the more poetic, are neglected, and they're not. As if they were not important at all. Look at any tree. It's mm-hmm. small branches, small leaves that feed the whole of the tree. Usually those smaller branches that mm-hmm. that create more excitement and more and feed the rest of the
of
the body.
That's exactly how the artists identify. When you say, when Jonas founded here with a cell in this incredible, somewhat abandoned, impoverished neighborhood, there were artists here.
Right.
Okay, there was Franz Klein, one of the prominent members of the Abstract Expressionist School, once said that artists live where dogs die, you know? So I think in some way they have observing Jonas doing his work over the years, and they grown with him. And they, in a way, a certain kind of solidified togetherness. And now when we decided to do this so-called benefit, which Jonas never done before, they all came to the rescue. And believe me, this is just the first troop who came together very quickly and offered their works for the auction. But I'm sure there are many others will come about very fast. We have a year, but we don't want to take time. We want to excel our making sure materialization.
Again, I would just simplify that. What we, our mission, main focus, our mission is like, okay, like in literature, there is prose, novelistic, and short story, etc. But there is also poetry. There is poetry. So we are like that poetry. But we represent. We don't dismiss. We represent at the same time all of history, all of the branches.
And
that is why we are very open now, when there are not that many theaters for foreign filmmakers. Mm-hmm. unless, you know, you are very, very big and from Hong Kong or, you know, some adventure or films, then we are very open. They come to us, you know. There are not that many places.
Yeah,
that
it was only about 2 weeks ago, my friend Adam Pennerton, who did a film where he interviewed Yvonne Renner. It was screened here. So many of the art world folks do make film, and some of them do get their chance to show here too. So it's not.
But I'm still. I have not given up on Hollywood. Let's say.
Oh.
There are people I know, not necessarily producers. There are. Mm-hmm. There are also actors. To make a film in Hollywood, we need, you know, there are different categories, and they buy art, and they listen to music, and they read poetry, and
right. Oh yeah.
So they are, you know, like us, like anybody else. So I have not given up on them, and I think, I hope that they will come to Anthology's support to help me to build the library for cinema. That cinema, all of cinema, if you look at the periodicals and the books that we have in the library, it covers all of cinema. It's not just one like the poetic avant-garde film, no.
I understand.
Well, we serve all of cinema.
All of cinema.
And the cafe will be very special. I want it to be also meeting ground. There is no place for filmmakers in New York to go get together and fight and
so
argue.
Not just argue. Right. Not just coffee grounds, but meeting grounds
yes,
as well.
Yes. It will be. I want it to be a meeting ground for filmmakers and all of the artists. I still remember, you see, the 60s, my filmmakers cooperative office was my loft, where it was not only the meeting ground of filmmakers. There was Allen Ginsberg and Robert Frank and Larry Rivers and
Rivers.
Musicians mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. and
Lou Reed, you know, everybody.
Laurie yes, Anderson.
Meeting ground for all of the artists.
I have to ask, it would be remiss not to ask you about your thoughts, Jonas, while I have you. About the threat to the National Endowments of Humanities and the Arts. We're in rough shape, so in a way I'm glad you've got this capital campaign.
I think it's not so much that if they close the National Endowment on the Arts, of course it will be followed maybe by closing also some state councils on the art also. But this, not that it's really a loss, direct, like visible, immediate loss, noticeable, you know, in the arts. But I think the idea, the attitude, the very attitude to cutting arts out from schools and in general, the attitude to the arts, that kind of negative attitude, that is worse. That is the worst part. Not that the money. The money. To me, was always a controversial part of the National Endowment and the councils on the art, because it comes down to who decides, and I was not always okay. I will make a very, very, very. Some people won't like what I'm going to say right now. I believe that, for instance, the destruction of the avant-garde cinema film in New York, at least I can talk about New York, and the states in general, it came from when the foundation support the monies from various councils became available. Their main body, classic body of the American avant-garde film, was created with no support from anybody. There was only one filmmaker who, during that whole, until 1967, had received a grant. That was Maya Deren once. Nobody else. It was done with pennies, with her own monies. And then when the grants came in, I began meeting filmmakers. I remember very well meeting Paul Sharitz one day and asking what he's doing. I said, no, I'm doing nothing. I did not get a grant this year. What? Did you need a grant before? Now suddenly you need a grant to do something? That kind, and then grants were given, but they were given to, this is completely new thing emerged around the same time, the emerging artist.
See, oh, I see, the emerging artist. But you're saying that it can be a crutch. It can be a crutch.
Yes.
That's what he's saying.
Yes.
I know.
And emerging artists. And
don't let it be a crutch.
And then
the
you
Lakers.
Look through the list, you know, who received the grant. Mm-hmm. Grants, it's same like with the Academy Awards, you know.
What Jonas meant is...
I am exaggerating to make the point.
Yeah.
But it's not 100%. Okay, it's good for art, like for symphony orchestras, for theaters. That,
for the greater public
I think National Endowment is... The city support is essential.
Yeah.
But when it comes to individual artists, I have problems. I have to tell you that.
So you see,
food for thought.
The
individual artists
for nonprofit, for NPR, you know, New York Opera, or any of that huge institution.
Yeah, because they serve the city, they serve the country.
Yes. The great.
And it could be a significant. It could be a good percentage of their budget. It could be relying on those grants. You know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, up to 10. I don't know percent, but for an individual artist, it might actually.
Though, as far as I know, the larger and the most important museums. Do not survive from the support of National Endowment or the city councils. Mm-hmm. They survive thanks to the trustees, to individuals.
Well, speaking of which, now that we are talking about individuals, it was in the news yesterday, wasn't it? Yesterday that David Rockefeller passed away at 101. I mean, talk about philanthropy, the arts. I mean, he was. Maybe the biggest.
Yeah, the whole family began very, very from the beginning, being Abby Nelson Rockefeller in the one of the trustees from the very get-go of Modern Museum.
Right. Yeah.
I believe in individuals, individual support.
Yeah.
I understand. Well,
the government should stay out of the arts.
Okay, that's
you see, I come from that background.
I know you do. In Lithuania, starting in Lithuania.
But
wait,
the Soviet Union.
They meddle too much. Yeah. Right now, the capital campaign. Where do people go if they go to Anthology Film Archive's website? I know there's a sponsorship page and all, but is there a place where people can go if they're interested in supporting the campaign?
We're still working with a very remarkable group called Jazzwood Production. So we meet fairly frequently, and hopefully we still increase that awareness, and they're going to help us to do that. And I think we have a good year, but again, I say earlier, we're going to be very proactive.
You go to Anthology Film Archives.
And it's also there, too, the website. But definitely, hopefully you could be part of that.
I plan on it, and I it's an honor. And also, one other good solution is actually come down to the Anthology Film Archive. You don't have to
corner
go to the website.
Of 2nd Avenue and 2nd Street.
Yeah, I can't forget that.
Two by two. It used to be, when it was still a courthouse building, that taxi drivers knew, used to know it as 2x2. Take me to 2x2, because the prison cells were supposedly were so small.
Oh my God!
That they were known as 2x2.
And
not only that, it is Second Avenue and Second Street, but the prison cells. There in this building, there were 14 prison cells. Originally, it was also a prison.
Holding cells.
Yes.
Right. Temporary holding cells. Well, yes. While people waiting for their trials or to be processed or what have you.
So the building is very, it's built, reinforced concrete.
Yeah. it's very raw. Very, it feels yes. like very, it's fantastic. Last thing, did you want to mention Documenta? What is that? And then
part this year of the, what's known as the Documenta that takes every 4 years, I think, in Kassel, in Germany. This year, the emphasis is on refugees, and also it takes place in Athens and Kassel, in two countries. So my part is I'm presenting the after the Second World War, I spent 5 years in displaced person camps, and I took a lot of photographs. So they are presenting my photographs from the displaced person camps of Kassel. And by coincidence, I spent 3 years in a camp in the suburbs of Kassel. And now I'm back in Kassel, the Documenta.
Wow.
So it's about the life, you know, refugees, because the main theme of Documenta this year is refugees.
What could be more timely?
It's a pertinent subject.
Also, it featured my book, I Had Nowhere to Go, my diary book, which is coming out also in German. There is new edition coming out in English and German.
Is that right? Because I read it, and I remember my friend Jacob Perlin. I'm sure that name rings a bell with you.
And also,
who lent me a video on video VHS, the diaries, and I watched all that a long time ago, of course. And I have the honor of being in a movie with your daughter Una, some years ago. But you remember the one in the wedding in the park, that crazy film? You remember that.
So the German edition is coming out.
But the new edition is coming out of that. That's
in
great.
English, yes.
I can't wait to get a copy of that. Cause
well, I mean, it seems timely.
And, of course, and part of it is also Douglas Gordon film, I Had Nowhere to Go, based on the book.
Based on the book. Yes. It's an incredible film. Again, it ties back to how Jonas have able to maintain all these seemingly complicated and multi-activities, and yet he is afloat to do his own work. So I always very impressed when someone asks Jonas, where you come from? He say, I came from Lithuania. I live in United States. But my country
is
New York. New York, not America.
In Williamsburg.
My country is culture. That's a different. And I think that's exactly what I would like to feel for myself. You know, my country is culture. So I think...
You see, what ties us also brought us together, Fong Bui, and myself, is that... Both of us went through the labor camp experiences. He's also, we are both survivors.
We're tough. We're very tender, but we're tough.
In different continents. And here we meet in New York, in Brooklyn.
Okay, well, you think you got it bad. I once got kicked out of summer camp a few weeks early, so... Sorry to try to talk you guys.
Summer camp. Summer camp.
Well, you know what? Even though I lack an experience of that intense level, Again, I am so grateful for the opportunity to be in your both of your company, and I mean that, and hear your stories.
But I'm happy that went through it all.
Oh, because, of course.
Because of that, I'm here.
That's right. Yep. That's right.
Yes.
That's right. And Jonas Mekas is one of the founders of the film anthology Del Marte with your brother, of course.
They all slowly dropped out. It was too much work.
It's too difficult.
Okay, I would like to just to
set the record straight.
But to say that actually I cannot claim starting any of what is being credited to me because it would have happened, I think, anyway.
Think?
I was only there at the right time to push to a little bit to keep it, to protect it. So I'm like a midwife. that's about it.
A doula.
Yeah. Helping.
Well, thank you, Jonas. You know, it's great, and you're fantastic. You're the ideal guest. Because you have so many wonderful stories, and I could talk to you for hours and days, I'm sure. And thank you.
And this building here.
And the building. Doing it here in this historic
Jack Smith
space.
Jack Smith developed his film, No President, in the basement of this building.
Is that right?
Yes, he developed and then hung on the pipes to dry it. I walked in and I saw, I could not believe my eyes. And Harry Smith was an artist in residence for 1 year here in this building. So it's full of history.
And we will soon have access to the documents of the history within the next couple of years, it sounds like. So that's great. Once they break ground and they... And Phong Bui, thank you very much. You are, the co-founder and the artistic director of the Brooklyn Rail.
Which is expanding now. There is a Miami-Brooklyn Rail.
There's third rail in the Twin City. And I'm very excited about the prospect of what we can do here in addition to building the cathedral, as Jonas say, of the heaven on a library and cafe. There are other possibilities. That maybe the art gallery can be renovated, and we can improve all kind of ways of programming and whatnot to allow more artists to perhaps collaborate with filmmakers and poets and musicians. So I'm very excited. Yeah.
Well, having lived and grown up in New York myself for 50 years, I've seen so many institutions disappear. So one of the main reasons I'm on board and want to help as much as I can is because I don't want to see another one.
We are not going to disappear because this building was built as a prison, reinforced concrete. It will stay at least 500 years.
Okay. Well, I plan to be around for that then. Well, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.
Where have you traveled? Where have you been? My tough weather friend, my childhood twin. But what do I tell you? Where to begin? I've spent time without and spent time within. I've battled through hellfire, panhandled sin. Vanished my gold and traded for tin. I've started out broad, I ended up thin. Gambled my life, but I never did win. And I pray I'll never feel the sharp edge of the steel. But I fear a revelation's gonna come. Tell me your story. Tell me your tale.
Music from this episode of Filmwax Radio is presented by the American Nomads. Their new album, Ghost Highway, is available for download. Put a link for more information and more details on our show notes. Actually, if you're in town, American Nomads will be playing a DROM. Is that how you say it? DROM, 85 Avenue A. Doors at 6:30. All music will be available today, Friday, the 21st of April. Again, Jennifer Marin writes about film and the arts and culture for many years. Her story is both inspiring as well as a little bit unsettling and what happened to her, but we're posting the show if it can help others. And reach out to Jennifer if you want to help her. She can use all the support, whether it's just reaching out and letting her know that you feel her outrage or what happened to her, to actual people you can write to and protest about what's going on in New York with these phony deeds that have become a problem, according to the mayor himself. So this also happens to be a great conversation with a great person, Jennifer Marin, on Filmwax Radio. Here we go. Let's go into that. Marin, how are you?
I'm, as they say, hanging in.
You are hanging
in. Yes, a friend of mine said to me when I asked him, how are you, Ed? And he said, I'm fine, and I'm also lying. So I think that that's how a lot of people are right now. But we'll say fine for the, you know, for all purposes.
Ed said that, as someone named Ed. Well, there's a sense of humor there, so that is a good thing, you know. I mean, at the end, one has to try at least to keep their sense of humor, too, because... You know, if you don't...
You're lost.
You're lost. You're completely lost. But so what brought us together, Jennifer, is that for the last couple of years, or maybe few years, I have been reading your dispatches on Facebook, mostly, about this really horrible experience that you went through.
I'm still going through.
And you're still going through, as is, you know... the law, often, and bureaucracy and all that, the legal system, et cetera. But before we get into some of the details about that and whatever you want to share, I also do want to know a little bit, and maybe people that are listening who don't know you may want to know a little bit also about you. You're a fixture here in New York in the in the media world. You are a writer.
Yes.
And you write about... More than film, but isn't that true?
Yes, that's true. I do write about film, and I also write about culture, and I've been a columnist with major media for quite a long time.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in New York. I was transported to Hollywood at a very young age with
Were
my
you
mom.
Sitting in a drugstore?
Was that? No. My mother was actually brought to Hollywood by Bertolt Brecht. And
on,
Charles Lossy, yes, to be and Sir Charles Laughton to be the original in the original production of Galileo. She played Mrs. Sarti, and I was just an infant, and I was packed into a trunk along with everything else and brought out to Hollywood, and I spent my childhood there.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm a polite person. I'm not going to ask what years, but, you know, one does wonder, wow, if you were living in Hollywood and your mom was an actress,
mm-hmm.
you might have been exposed to pretty amazing things growing up and maybe even taking them for granted, but... Still.
I was, and I met a lot of very interesting people, and I was surrounded by very interesting people all the time, mm-hmm. and I was very curious and... apparently agreeable, because they didn't kick me out of the room when they were talking about stuff.
Right. Kids weren't necessarily always well regarded. They were looked at, quiet, seen but not heard.
Yeah, and I wasn't in that company. They were very supportive of me and welcomed my questions, welcomed my comments and my opinions about things.
Were these like artists, I suppose?
They were artists and actors and blacklisted writers and a whole bunch of people. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So see, you're giving away the time frame now.
Yeah.
So
no. I can guess there's absolutely no hiding here.
I'm a senior
citizen.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's post-war. Okay. Obviously. Yeah.
Right. Wow. You grew up there, and then I'm going to guess, and you can correct me, of course, maybe you went to school outside of Southern California. You went to school, and then you ended up in New York?
I was born here, and in fact, the first home that I knew was the house that was stolen from me. And when we went out to California, we lived there for a number of years, but my grandfather was getting old, and my mom felt that she wanted to spend time with him and she wanted me to spend time with him. And her career was movable since she was an actor and could work either on either coast. We moved back to New York and I went to junior high school. I had to repeat a grade because I'd been skipped in California and I was too young to be admitted into the grade that I was actually in New York. So I had to get set back for a year. And I went to junior high school in Forest Hills and then moved into Manhattan when we went to Music and Art.
Oh, may I interrupt you?
Yeah.
You went to junior high school in Forest Hills. May I ask which school you went to?
Russell Sage Junior High School.
Okay. Now, may I share with you that I, too, attended Russell Sage Junior
No
High School.
No way.
Yes, indeed. I grew up in Forest Hills.
Oh, my God. That's so weird. Yeah. Did you have George Alexander as a teacher?
I don't
She was my art teacher.
Oh,
no. She saved me.
Yeah, I had one of those, too, but not Georgia. No, not Georgia. Georgia?
No, George.
Oh,
her
George.
Name. She was a woman with the name of George.
Well,
she was fantastic.
More than one.
Yeah.
Wow. No, I did not. I did not. I didn't. Maybe she had left or retired.
Yeah, and anyway, I took the test for music and art, and I got in where I was an art student, and I graduated from music and art and then went to Clark University where I studied. Did you go to Clark, too?
No, okay. But it's a good school. It's in Massachusetts. I have a cousin who attended.
Yeah, I graduated from there and studied really the history of ideas, which is kind of something that I made up. Didn't really exist, but I took honors in painting and fine arts at the Worcester Museum School. And then I graduated and came to New York and worked for a year and decided that really I wanted to act, something that I had been discouraged from doing by my mom because she said it was a difficult career, and she's right. And I gradually decided that that's something that I wanted to do and applied for the first class at Tisch for acting, grad acting. And I was accepted, and I went to Tisch, and off I was.
Who was your teacher?
I had several teachers.
Who ran the program?
Ted Hoffman at the time.
Okay.
And Peter Cass was one of my teachers. Mel Shapiro was another teacher. Omar Shapley was another teacher. Hovey Burgess, who's still there, was one of my teachers.
I ask again because my son's mother graduated maybe 7 or 8 years ago.
Oh, well, that's
program.
Much later than
yes.
me. But no, I know one of my classmates took over, Ron Van Loo. He was a wonderful guy.
Yeah. And Zelda became?
Zelda Fitchhandler. I knew Zelda. Yeah, I knew Zelda because my mom had worked at the Arena Stage for Zelda, and Zelda was
away.
Yeah, Zelda and my mom were good friends.
And then you became a journalist, or I mean,
I became a journalist because I went to work in Japan, where I was the only gaijin in a very famous Japanese theater, the only actress, foreign actress, and it was kind of unusual. And I got asked to write about that by. Richard Schechner, who was running the Drama Review at the time, and I found suddenly that I really liked having my own voice rather than mouthing other people's dialogue.
I see. But what was the play? What was this production?
It wasn't a production. It was a company. It was called Tenjo Sajiki. It was run by a Japanese director named Tsuji Terayama. And I met him at La Mama, where I was in one of his productions, and then he invited me to join his company. And off I went to Japan, and we performed in Japan, we performed in Holland, we performed in France, and eventually I decided that it was time to come home. It was it was a very extraordinary experience.
Oh, gosh.
You know, and I made movies while I was in Japan as well. Shoste o Machi Dayo and Operation Salary Man.
Great. Can I see these two films? Are they hard
Shoste o Machi Dayo is available on DVD.
Okay.
I don't know about Operation Salary Man, Escape from Salary Man. That was it. And I had to after record myself in Japanese, which was really quite an interesting and fun experience and very strange.
Do you speak any still?
Yeah, a little bit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can sort of get by, but I don't advertise that because Japanese is a very complicated language and it's really essential to be polite. And I don't know that I rise to that level when speaking Japanese.
Okay, we'll put you on the spot. All right, so here you are now a journalist. Is it the 80s or 70s?
Senkyu nanaju ichi nen deshita. That was in 1971. And I came back again. And when I came back, I was asked to write about that experience, and I did so. And then I went to work with a theater company that was doing theater in jail. It was a company called Theater for the Forgotten, and it was run by Marketa Kimbrell. And they said to they were looking for funding, and they said, we need an article done, and we need so that we can use it to get funding, and you've written an article, so why don't you write an article about us, and then that'll help us get funding. And I said, well, for whom? And they said, well, what about the Christian Science Monitor? And I said, okay. And I called the Christian Science Monitor, and I pitched this article about Theater for the Forgotten and teaching in jail, and they said, sure. And so that happened.
You don't know that these doors are open to you until you knock on them.
This is true. I've never disliked an opportunity, though. Mm. So anyway, I wrote the article. They liked it, and I wound up writing for the Christian Science Monitor, you know, from time to time, and then and then just actually switched from being on stage to writing about it and writing about festivals and other things.
Okay, so there you become now an arts reviewer and
cultural journalist. Yeah.
Wow. So, and and I mean, my God, the Science Christian Monitor. The Christian Science Monitor. What is the circulation of that magazine then? It must have been,
I don't know.
Hundreds of thousands.
It was lots.
I mean, there was, was a very big, I don't know about now. I know it still exists, but it must have been
it was huge. And the thing about it that was even more important, I think, than the numbers was the degree of respect that it had, because it was very credible. And they were very rigorous as editors. But I had the kind of mind, apparently, that they appreciated, except that I would tend to use the word coffee, which was off the charts. Coffee was not, you know, a drink would be the required word for coffee, a hot drink, because it contained caffeine, and there were Christian Science principles that were kind of abided by.
Okay. Well, I mean, I guess that exists everywhere.
Exactly.
Okay, so, you know, so as I mentioned at the beginning of the conversation, I've known or seen you and for many years, even before I got to know you a little bit, I would see you. Because also you would always have these great questions at the Q&As at press conferences.
Thanks. And
sure. So I was like, oh, who's that lady? And, you know, and so, you know, and then got to know you a little bit in the last 2 or 3 years and started to read this story that you were writing about. And it just broke my heart. And I was very frustrated and for you, I found. So, you know, I feel like considering how much you've contributed, you know, I really felt like this is if a few people even can, more people can understand what you've been dealing with and be their support in some level or another, great.
Yeah, so. Well, I have been very gratified in a way, although gratification is not actually the right word because nobody would want to go through this kind of experience. But the interest that the public has shown via news media has been extremely supportive and has really kept me afloat during times of terrible depression because of this. It has. Yeah. This is a crime that affected me. I called it a state rape, and really it obliterated my family legacy, our generational wealth, and everything else. And it had a terrible effect on me, emotionally extremely draining, and economically disastrous. So, right.
And these are the years that, you know, one would hope and counts on to be the salad years. You know what I mean? Like, in other words, these are the years you're supposed to be able to lean back on the fruit of all of your past years of work. And meanwhile, you get this thrown in your
mean, I was headed in that direction and privileged to be so headed. Mm-hmm. And I realized that a lot of people don't have that kind of privilege, so that my angst was born of privilege. But that being said, it doesn't make the angst any less.
No.
And I am fortunate in being articulate and having the kind of family DNA that's pit bull enough not to let go of something like this and just dissolve in a puddle of butter.
Yeah.
You know, that I'm hoping that my adversity will make a change for the better for other people. That's what my family legacy must now be. The wealth, the antiques that were going to be, that were stolen, that were intended to be in museums so that people could know about my family and enjoy those objects are gone. That's all gone. And I've not been able to trace it at all. So my family legacy has to become something else. And I feel that changing the law and that protecting people, changing the degree to which victims are and their concerns are respected and treated decently becomes family legacy.
Do you feel like you're a victim?
I am a victim. I am a victim of a very major crime.
Right.
Let's
mention the crime. I knew even as I was asking you, the experience of having your home stolen from under you makes you a victim, of course. And then I wonder how long one can tolerate and grapple with this should not define who I am as well. And you're going about it exactly the right way, you know, as you just described a minute ago, which is to turn that victimhood into something of a legacy, you know, a positive one. But now tell the story. I know you've told the story countless times.
What happened was that I received a water bill that was way too high.
Where were you living?
I was in my apartment in Manhattan. The family house is in Queens. It was maintained as, you know, fully furnished, all the bills paid, the lights on and off, the heat and hot water and all of that, you know, paid and running and ready. I was there frequently, and I was maintaining the place kind of as a sanctuary. It was the place where I communed with my family, all of whom are dead, and I showed respect to them and maintained that with the idea that someday when I was too old and feeble to take care of myself in my apartment, I would invite somebody in equal feebleness to come and share the place with me, and we would hire someone to come and take care of us. It was a beautiful home. It was filled with antiques, and it was in great condition.
Where in Queens?
It's in Laurelton. It's in Laurelton, and that's fairly near JFK.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, just a beautifully beautiful house with a very peaceful vibe and a tremendous emotional significance for me.
Sure, it makes sense.
Yeah, so I found out, I got this water bill, and I called the water board, which is a New York City department, ready to have a big fight with somebody about that they were cheating me. And they said, they pointed me to, you know, a chart that's online, and it showed that the water was being turned on and off. There was water consumption. If that line had been flat, that would have indicated a leak. It was going up and down.
Okay.
That meant usage.
What can I ask you?
Yeah.
When did this happen? In
May of 2014.
Okay.
So I said, that's impossible. There's nobody in the house. I'm the only person who has a key, and I'm the only person who goes. And they said, well, why don't you call the police and find out what's going on, because you may have a squatter. So I called the police straight away, and I got somebody to go out to the house, and they called me when they were at the house, and they said, do you have tenants? And I said, absolutely not. Whoever's in that house doesn't belong there. Arrest them. And they said to me, we can't do that. We don't know who you are. You're a voice on the phone. And they claim that they are living there legitimately. You come out tomorrow and call 911. And I did that.
Did you go alone?
No, I asked a friend of mine to come with me, a guy, because I was afraid to go alone.
I would assume so. I would have, and I'm a guy.
Yeah. And
I would have taken
I mean,
you
over
me. Now I definitely would take you.
I'm not tough physically, maybe in other ways, but not very tough actually emotionally. But I am stubborn, that's for sure, persistent, to put it that way. Sure. So I went out there, and I met the police officer who said to me that he actually went up and knocked on the door. It was a sergeant. A lieutenant from the 105th precinct. Went up and banged on the door, and there was a dog inside. And he said, well, that complicates matters, because if we knock down the door, we need to have animal rescue services here, and or else I'll wind up shooting it, and that's not allowed. I mean, it was a point at which he said he couldn't take action, and he also more or less explained to me, he couldn't determine who was the rightful owner or occupant of the house, because that's a matter that is determined by a court if there are two claimants to that. I had overnight actually found out that there was in fact a deed that had been registered with the city registrar that was available for viewing on ACRIS, which indicated that Darrell Beatty was the owner of the house that had been sold to him by somebody named Edith Moore. Neither of those two people had any relationship to our home, our family, or anything else. Furthermore, overnight, I was able to discover, just on the internet, that the address that was given for Edith Moore, the seller, did not even physically exist. I mean, it was that obviously fraudulent a deed. Mm. And, you know, there were other elements that show that it was what is known legally as flawed.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you know if it was Darrell the victim of something, or was he in? Or was he the victim of fraud too?
I did not know that at the time.
No, okay. Good.
Yeah, I did not know that at the time. Okay. I just knew that he was in the house, or somebody was in the house. I didn't even know that Darrell Beatty was in the house, because I hadn't confronted him.
Right.
Oh, but actually, I'm sorry, that's not true. Actually, I did know that somebody named Darrell Beatty was in the house, because the police officer who went out the night before told me that the name of the person was Darrell Beatty.
And I also saw to him
that day. And I also did see on the deed that the name Darrell Beatty was there as the owner. So I started doing all of the research that any kind of investigative journalism has taught me to do, and came up with a bunch of stuff. I went out there. They wouldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. I was sitting there in the car, and it was a rented car, in front of the house, hoping to see somebody go in and out and take photographs or confront them with, what are you doing in my house, basically. And there was somebody who was driving back and forth in a car, passed by several times, and did not stop. But I'm an observant person, put it that way. And he looked somewhat like the Darrell Beatty that I'd seen on Facebook, actually, after doing all of this research the night before. So I said to my friend, nobody's going to stop and go in the house if we're sitting here. And I asked one of the neighbors if they saw Darrell Beatty going, or anybody going into my house, to call me on my cell phone. I drove around to the back of the house, at which point I discovered that the garage was broken into, my car was missing, and things from the house, from the interior, my grandfather's bed set, for example, broken up and stored, smashed into the stuff.
stuffed into the garage from the interior of the house. So the garage is separate, and there's a garden in between the garage and the back door to the house.
Is there an alley behind the...
It's not an alley. It's a full street.
Okay.
But it's a street-to-street lot that's occupied by a house,
okay.
Our house. And our house is an attached house, actually.
Oh, okay.
So that... Anyway, so I went back up through on the walkway and looked in the back door, which is basically glass, and on the interior, in the interior, there was blinds that were covering the windows and the back door, and I could see through a tear. The blinds had been in perfect condition. They were vintage, beautiful wooden blinds, but torn, and I could see that the furniture, including a four-tier Lalique chandelier, crystal chandelier that had been hanging over the dining room table, and one of two palace vases that was in the dining room. They were palace vases that were 17th century Chinese porcelain palace vases that stood taller than I do now. They're magnificent antiques, a pair of them, that one of them, I couldn't see the other because it was out of the line of sight, were missing. I could see that other items were missing, and that the interior was, the dining room furniture was gone. The interior was basically very bleak, and everything, the order had completely disturbed, and most of what had been furnishings in the house that I could see were gone.
It was heartbreaking.
I was horrified.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I went back. I called the police when I saw that my car was missing. They sent somebody out again. And those police officers took a report on the missing car. They could not take a report on anything that was in the house because I couldn't get in the house.
Right.
So, and then the next day I called the district attorney.
Okay.
And I got the district attorney over providing a lot of evidence and a lot of things that I had researched. I managed to get the district attorney to be interested in the case. And I also called the news media because I found out that deed theft was indeed a huge problem in New York City. Huge problem. And that was the beginning of what has been an ordeal, going through two lawsuits, civil lawsuits, in order to get the house back. One was to get Darryl Beatty evicted from the house because he was squatting in it, and the second was to get the fraudulent deed set aside and the deed reestablished in my name.
Yeah. Okay. You did indeed get him evicted eventually.
He was evicted.
It took a year or two, right?
No. He was evicted in November.
Well, again, remind me when you were...
I found out in May.
This all transpired in May. By November, that fall...
I had initiated the two lawsuits. I had...
One against the
Darryl
Beatty.
They were both against Darryl Beatty.
Oh, okay.
One was to get him evicted as a squatter.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was to get the deed back in my name. His deed had to be set aside. Now, I mean, you asked me whether Darryl Beatty could have been a victim as well. Darryl Beatty claimed to be a victim, but he used the fraudulent deed, which he knew it was fraudulent because he's already been asked about it and claimed that it was a fraudulent deed and he knew nothing about it. He tried to use that fraudulent deed to get services on my house. Because I turned the gas off, and he tried to negotiate for a new gas contract with using the fraudulent deed, which is clearly against the law. The point that I'm making...
Yeah, you were getting the utility bills. Right?
I was getting utility... And the city was, at the same time as it registered the fraudulent deed, giving him the right to the house, the city was charging me taxes and water on the house that they had given by virtue of recognizing the deed to Darryl Beatty, thereby depriving me of my property, a property right that I hold under the Constitution without due cause. So the issue of whether Darryl Beatty was a victim or not. He claims that he was a victim. He claimed that he told the I haven't seen the actual interview, but I've heard that he claimed that he had rented the house off of Craigslist and had given a certain amount of money to this person that he didn't know, who lives ostensibly in Brooklyn, and that he had no receipt for that, and he could prove nothing. But he claimed that that was the case, and that he had moved in, and that was that. He said nothing about the stolen property. He said nothing about how the house was filled or not filled when he moved in. I don't know the date when he actually moved in, but I do know that it was after the deed in his name was filed. So if he didn't write that deed and he was not responsible for it, what the hell is his name doing on that deed that was filed before he moved in, before he claims he got a lease, you know, or rented the house?
Right, that doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense at all.
No.
But it's not provable evidence in court. So anyway, the bottom line is Darrell Beatty got arrested. He was charged with 11 felony counts for economic crimes. And he was arrested at the court in Queens where we were having a hearing for his eviction. We had the news media was there. I think
people can Google or, you know, go online and see some of this coverage. It's
absolutely
still available on various media outlet websites.
Yeah, if they Google my name, Jennifer Merrin, M-E-R-I-N, and the word Laurelton, or even just my name, because
yeah,
this is what I am now known for.
Yeah, this is at the top of your search results.
Exactly right.
Got it.
I mean, so, but the thing is that we were conferencing his eviction. He was making claims that were totally ridiculous and specious. He had not responded to a hearing, a scheduled hearing, and an order of eviction was signed with a 10-day period of execution. In other words, 10 days had to pass before
right,
he was evicted. And instead of having that happen, he came in a day before the scheduled eviction, and he said that he did an order to show cause to reinstate this because he had ostensibly been in the hospital on the day that that hearing had happened, and the court automatically grants that stay. So he got to stay for a longer period of time, and the new hearing was scheduled. And at that hearing, he did appear, and we were in conference with the judge's clerk, and the judge was to hear now the case. We had to, in order to get from the conference room into the court. So, en route from the conference room into the court, he was arrested. So we went before the judge, and he wasn't there. So the judge granted him an automatic stay until such time as he could appear, because he was now arrested. The Department of Corrections, who had him in custody, does not ever, under any circumstances, I found out, produce anybody to civil court on any scheduled hearing. So if he had been jailed and not gotten out of jail for a year, my house would not have been returned to me. He would have been squatting, or his son would have been squatting in my house for an extra year. As it turned out, he was given several months extra to be squatting in my house. And that was even a longer delay on my being able to report the burglary and have anything happen with the police actually looking for my stolen property. In November, when he was evicted and I could make out a burglary report, the investigative detective who was assigned to that burglary deemed it an old case and pretty much closed it without doing any inspecting at all on it. So that was the end of that. I tried to fight against that. I got nowhere. The captain of the precinct was hanging up on me. I mean, it was that bad. It was horrible. But, you know, like I said, I'm very persistent.
Hmm.
So the point is that Darrell Beatty was sentenced ultimately. He did a plea bargain. He confessed to one of the 11 counts felony counts with which he was charged. And in exchange for that, he was given what I consider to be a very minimal sentence for all the chaos and
right.
causing me to lose my family savings and fighting in court to get my house back.
Right.
He got a year in jail. I thought that was way short.
Of course.
So we had a sentencing hearing at which I was allowed, it was my right, to make a victim statement. That took place on September the 8th of 2016. And I gave my statement in Queens Criminal Court. And the judge, Judge Michael Alois, after hearing my statement, said, and this is on the record, that he found it one of the most compelling and sincere statements, victim statements, that he'd heard in all of his years on court, sitting on the bench. And I had requested that he recommend that Darryl Beatty do his full sentence without the possibility of parole, and that if there were a parole being considered, that I be given the right to speak at that hearing, notified of it, and be given the right to speak at it. So I was very shocked. this sentencing hearing happened on September the 8th of last year.
Yeah.
I was very shocked when about three weeks ago, I discovered that Darryl Beatty, and I did this just by looking around online, not by having been notified or anything else. I discovered that Darryl Beatty was scheduled to be released in April of this year, not in September, 5 months early.
Sir, having served 7 months.
Eight months. And I was just totally horrified and shocked. So my new challenge became, how do I find out how that happened, why it happened, and how do I protest it, and how do I get it reversed? And that's what I'm facing right now. Mm-hmm. I have for 3 weeks been on a mission to discover who has the authority to reverse that decision. And I have found out who. And I'll tell you that I have, in order to find out who, I have spoken to the district attorney, the Commissioner of Corrections, Department of Corrections under Commissions, the Board of Corrections, the New York City Public Advocate, the district attorney. I tried to reach the judge, but never got through. And then, finally, I spoke to the mayor.
And you spoke to the mayor,
Mayor
of New York?
De Blasio.
You did?
Yes. I got to speak to Mayor de Blasio. And how did I do that? I went and I stood there. I went to a town meeting that I found out about. He was supposed to be there. I went there. I had my hand up for the entire time. Nobody called on me. The meeting was called to a halt, terminated. Some citizens who were attending noticed how upset I was and that I'd been really trying to be heard. And a woman came over to me and said, what's the issue? You need to speak. I can see that. And I told her what the issue was. I was near tears. I was in a meltdown, frankly.
Yeah. And you just found this.
I was determined that I was going to present mm-hmm. this issue to mm-hmm. the mayor, because I was being bounced from pillar to post. Everyone was pointing, no, he's responsible, no, he's responsible, no, they're responsible, they make the decision, blah, 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 blah. This is public, this is correctional law number whatever it was, something, it's number, correctional law number, I think it's 803, it's either 802 or 803 or 804, but I think it's 803, provides for early release for good behavior. But it's not mandatory. It's discretionary. Mm-hmm. And if it's discretionary, that means somebody makes a decision on it. I don't care whether if it's the person who enters it into a computer, they make the decision, they're responsible. I just wanted to find out who that was so that I could tell them, turn it around. And I was being literally bounced from pillar to post. I was so frustrated. I was crazed by this, obsessed by it, actually, finding out. Because I think it's my right as a citizen, and it's my responsibility as a victim to stand up for my rights. So, and for the rights of other victims who are similarly shunted aside, kicked to the curbside by this system. So So this woman came up to me and said, and she said, I'm going to stand online. You're going to meet the mayor. I'm going to stand online. You're going to come up when it's your turn, and you're going to tell him what happened. Meanwhile, I was just having a meltdown. I was suddenly surrounded by people, including the security guards. And I just thought, okay, that's fine. Arrest me for wanting to speak with the mayor. That's good. Go ahead. You want a news story? You got one there, kids. Mm-hmm. The news was there. I mean, mm-hmm. they were there. They knew because they knew that mm-hmm. this was going on. So anyway, I stood in line. And when I got up to the mayor, I told him, I needed to ask you a question. And I said, my house was stolen. I mean, told him very briefly what had happened and that this guy's getting out early. Who has the authority to reverse that? And he called over somebody and he said, this is a woman who will help you. And she'll call the Department of Corrections. And I said, I've already been to the Department of Corrections. And he said to me, yeah, but you're not the mayor.
Right.
So I was suddenly being helped by Mayor de Blasio's, not directly, but by his office.
Right.
Yeah. And I found out through that and a response that I had from the public advocate that actually the person who has the authority to do something about this, and it was stated to me in unequivocal terms, the person with authority to reverse this is the judge. So I called, and this time I got through to not Judge Alois, but to his clerk. And his clerk informed me that that Judge Alois is on vacation until March the 29th. Well, Daryl Beatty's scheduled to get out in April, and I wasn't exactly sure of what day. And I didn't want him to be released before this issue could be dealt with. So I've been now on a mission to get either a stay or an injunction against this early release or somehow something to stop it. And I've been told that Judge Alois will have the opportunity to do something between the time of his return and Daryl Beatty's release, which is now, I think, scheduled for April the 30th. So that's where we are right now.
Yeah, 5 or 6 weeks away.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's where we are on that one.
Thank you for sharing that story.
It's a long story. I talked until you're blue in the face.
No, it's so fine. Don't worry about it. That's why you're here. If people want to try to help and you, and what can people do? What can sympathetic listeners do?
I think that this situation needs to be reversed so that Daryl Beatty does do his full term in jail. And looking beyond that, I think there needs to be additional legislation mm-hmm. in New York. I think that this law needs to be changed. And here's why. It doesn't make sense to let somebody out of jail for good behavior while they're in custody. That's how it reads. A third off for good behavior. The point is that the DA and the judge made a commitment to a year in jail for Daryl Beatty. Why? Because that was deemed to be commensurate with his crime, right? He did the crime, he does the time. The time is a year. If, in fact, he commits some sort of infraction while he's in jail, he should be sentenced. That's a new crime. He should be sentenced to that crime anew so that then he will do a year and some, whatever that sentence is,
mm-hmm.
not vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he's behaving well while he's in custody has absolutely no impact. It serves as no restitution to me, the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the law there for? The law is there for society, but I'm part of society. The law is there to protect me. I support the law to protect society, and by doing that, I protect myself. So that's true for everybody, and it's got to be true for the courts as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point. I want that law changed. I want that law. Initially, it was enacted, I understand, in order to give nonviolent criminals the opportunity to, or the incentive to behave so that they can get out in less time. I understand that. But when you're standing in a jail, in a jailhouse, when you're sitting in a cell with guards standing around you, I think the guards standing around you ought to be the incentive not to do anything egregious. You know?
Well, yeah.
I'm an idealist, but I do think that. But you know, you're rewarding prisoners for doing what they're supposed to, not doing
this
what they're not supposed to do.
This is sort of the bottom line as it is. You don't get, so you didn't do anything wrong. You shouldn't be rewarded for not doing wrong. You should be, you know.
You should do your time and get out and start on a fresh page.
Yeah.
That's it.
Right. That should be the contract.
That's right.
Well, people can reach Jennifer, by the way, she's on Facebook. She's a presence on Facebook. So if you're curious, look her up. And you can, like I say, also look at some of the interviews that she's had with the various news outlets as well for more information. And in the meantime, what is the status of the house in Laurelton?
Well, the house in Laurelton is now, it's back in my name. Daryl Beattie is out. I have possession of the house, but Daryl Beattie left
it in ruins.
Ruins.
Yeah.
And it's not livable as it is right now. I have no chance of any kind of restitution from him because he has no traceable assets. Mm-hmm. I have spent an enormous amount of money in lawsuits getting the house back in my name and getting him evicted. And I have sued the city. DLA Piper, which is an enormously respected and one of the top 10 ranked law firms in the United States, has taken the case, suing the city for damages and for negligence, basically, in filing the fraud, in registering the fraudulent deed without doing any kind of research on it. And apparently the city has changed its ways, has instituted several different measures that have been taken, but since the lawsuit broke in the news, or since my case broke in the news, but those measures are not working because there are new cases.
As far as you know or can tell, is this maybe the most reported? Do you think it's the most widely reported, locally speaking, of course?
It's been very widely reported as far as the Daily Mail. I mean, it's been very widely reported. I think that the initial coverage in the news did spur the Department of Tax and Finance to make some changes regarding the registration. There's sensibly now red flags that go up and cases referred to the sheriff's office. I don't know that there's been any further prosecution. I know of two cases now that are current, one in Manhattan and one in Brooklyn, that owners of homes were not informed, as they should have been, when there were attempts made to change the deed from one party to another, and there were red flags.
Some of these are personal. These individuals know each other, right? I assume that they're not always strangers.
I don't know. No, I don't know. I think that there's that this is a widespread crime in New York City right now. When I spoke with the mayor about it, he said, yeah, that's a big issue.
Okay.
So, I mean, it is a very widespread crime. It's still going on. There are new little tweaks in the scam. And the city, basically, I mean, if the city does not stand behind deeds that are registered, then deeds have no value whatsoever, and nobody can prove that they own their house at all.
Right. One shouldn't have to spend their savings to prove something that is
sacrosanct.
Is legal.
A deed should be sacrosanct.
Right, exactly.
And if the city is selling the assurance by registering it that a property is owned by an individual, and the assurance is that deed being registered, then the city is selling a fraudulent product. It's selling not a flawed product, a product, and there's a product, as far as I'm concerned, liability issue here.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your being
so the next so story is what happens.
Yeah.
The next story is what happens with that law case. The city has now been granted two extensions on responding, because the city is automatically granted extensions on responding that nobody else is granted.
No.
Right. I mean, a city sets in...
I think you need to legally get legal status as a city, Jennifer. That's your answer.
I will declare 226... yes, I'll declare my house a city.
If corporations can be people, why can't people be cities?
I don't understand. That's a really good question. Let's discuss that. I think, though, that cities are corporate entities.
Municipalities
yeah. are corporate entities,
yes.
and they cannot be above the law. They cannot set themselves above the law, which is what New York City has done.
Jennifer Marin, thank you very much. And we'll visit again with an update soon, okay?
Yeah, sounds good to me. And we can talk movies as well, because I love them.
Oh, we'll do that next time.
Okay.
That's much less stressful.
Much less stressful.
I'm all wound up myself now. I feel like I'm going to go out to Laurelton and at the end of April.
I hope. I mean, you asked what can people do. I mean, I think if they write to the mayor,
yeah.
I think if they write to the Commissioner of Corrections, I think if they write to Judge Michael Alois, A-L-O-I-S-E, at the
Good.
Criminal Court,
yes, write to
and
Michael
to the District
Alois.
Attorney.
When he comes back from his vacation in next week, there should be a stack of envelopes advocating for your case.
That would be
and
fantastic.
And for keeping Daryl Beattie in the slammer.
For his entire term. In the pokey,
yeah. Thank you again.
Thank you very much, Adam.
Thanks. There you go, folks. I'm proud of that show. I mean, you know, what more can you ask for? By the way, a little bit more information came in from the guys at American Nomads. The album should be available for download today, Friday, April 21st, on iTunes, Amazon, and Spotify. If you liked what you heard. Folks, you know, I always plead, and it looks like, I have to say, in the last week, a bunch of people did, in fact, put their reviews down on my show. Now, look, it's not just for me so I can read great reviews of my show. It's not. The reason that I put it there is because, I experimented the other day, I looked under other podcasts that on the category of film, and guess what? My show actually appeared as a suggested show, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get it up there and get it up there more frequently. And the only way to really do it is for all of you who are listening right now to just go onto iTunes, if you have an iTunes account, and just plug in. There's a tab on that FilmWax Radio iTunes page. It says ratings and reviews, and you just go in there, click on a star, and then also put in a few words. That's all you have to do. And also just supporting the show in general, you know, like following us on Twitter and Instagram and friending us on or liking our FilmWax Radio page. All that is really, really, really helpful. So thank you so much for doing that. And stay in touch. And we'll be back next week. I believe Karen Cooper of Film Forum will be one of the guests. There's going to be some stuff from the Tribeca Film Festival and more. Lots of great conversations coming up on all the upcoming shows on this podcast, which is called Film Wax Radio, which happens to be part of the Showbriz Studios podcast network, presented by Rooftop Films. So take care of yourself, my friends, and the ones you love. Until next time. Broken line.